Welcome to the Success in Medicine podcast. I'm Dr. Rajani Katta, author of the best-selling residency match guide, The Successful Match, and creator of the Residency Interview 101 course. This is a special series on the podcast called Energized at Work. We hear so much about burnout in medicine, and it is a real and very challenging problem. That's why I wanted to learn from doctors in all types of specialties who are the opposite of burned out. These are the doctors who are energized by work. I'm looking forward to sharing lessons and secrets from these doctors on this special series.
I'm so excited to invite onto the podcast today Dr. Caitlin Sutton. And one of the reasons I was really excited to have Dr. Sutton speak to us is because she has a really interesting career path, and she's also been able to introduce different aspects of her career. So Dr. Sutton is one of my colleagues here in Houston, and she is chief of the maternal fetal anesthesia division at Texas Children's Hospital, which is one of the best children's hospitals in the country. And she is a professor in both pediatric and obstetric anesthesia, which I think is really interesting. And then the other area, Dr. Sutton, I'm really excited to talk to you about is the fact that she's a certified healthcare ethics consultant. So Dr. Sutton, welcome to the podcast and thank you for coming on today.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for having me. I've been really, really looking forward to talking with you and connecting with your audience. This is a real pleasure and an honor.
Yay. Well, just I want to ask you just a basic question, first of all, which is, what does it mean to do pediatric and obstetric anesthesia in the work that you do?
That is a great question. And, you know, there are not that many of us who do that combination. So in anesthesia, as you know, you have a four-year residency, and then there are fellowships. And all of the fellowships for anesthesia are just 1 year. So there's pediatrics, there's obstetrics, there's critical care, there's cardiac. And a lot of people, because the fellowships are so short, will combine two fellowships and do one after the other. Some people, very commonly, I think people will do cardiac anesthesia and ICU because those clearly go together. What might not so obviously go together are pediatrics and obstetrics. And I combined both of those. I did my obstetric anesthesia fellowship first for 1 year, followed by a 1 year fellowship in pediatrics. To tell the truth, I did those because I loved those both the most. And I didn't really know how they would fit together until a colleague who's now my partner introduced the idea of fetal anesthesia or maternal fetal anesthesia, where you actually do both of those things at the same time. So I do a lot of anesthesia for fetal surgeries, which means I'm taking care of a pregnant patient and also her fetus who's having surgery before it's born.
And I remember when you first told me about some of the surgeries that you are involved in, it sounds like science fiction, you know, even right. Like when I went to medical school, this would be science fiction. Tell, if you could please share with our listeners some of what these surgeries are.
Sure. So there's a range of different types of these surgeries. I kind of think of them in three groups. One is a very minimally invasive type of procedure where we're just inserting a camera through a scope into the uterus, or maybe even a needle-based ultrasound guided procedure. The most common for that would be where we laser unusual or incorrect arteriovenous connections or vascular connections on the placenta for something called twin-twin transfusion syndrome. And so that's just using lasers to get those vascular connections and improve the likelihood of a good outcome for both twins in a monochorionic diamniotic pregnancy. So that's the minimally invasive. My favorite is the mid-gestation, the more, a little bit more complex. And the most prototypical of those would be a spina bifida repair. At Texas Children's, we do that fetoscopically, which means there's an open abdomen, you exteriorize the uterus, you bring the uterus out, and then we put in two ports that are very small, less than a centimeter incisions on the uterus, and then the surgeons repair the spina bifida. And we close up those ports, we put the uterus back in, and then that patient, because it was so minimally invasive on the uterus, can still deliver vaginally in that same pregnancy. And then the third group is an exit procedure, which is kind of like a modified C-section. And that is where the fetus is not expected to survive the transition from fetal to neonatal life for some reason. The most common kind of prototypical idea there is maybe a giant neck mass or an airway malformation, where they need to get an airway, maybe a trach, or be intubated before they deliver so that they don't have that period of time where they're not getting oxygenation. And so we do a modified C-section where we deliver maybe the head and shoulders. We do whatever intervention we need to do, like a trach or place the breathing tube, while the baby is still getting blood and oxygen from the placenta. So on kind of bypass, if you will, from the placenta. And then once that intervention is done, you finish the delivery and deliver the baby.
Whoa.
so three different groups.
So I actually did not know that you're doing all of that. I had heard a little bit about fetal surgery. But even just that thought that you're exteriorizing, I think that's, no, externalizing is the word that you use, the uterus, and then you're putting ports into the uterus and then they're operating.
Yeah.
I mean, my goodness. And so you are the one that's watching both the fetus and the mother?
Yes. Yeah, so depending on the type of surgery at Texas Children's, we do this where if we have two patients, for example, or sometimes three, depending on if it's twins, where there is a more complex surgery, or one of the patients is more medically complex, or there's a likelihood or possibility of delivery, then we'll have two anesthesiologists. So we will both be there. At our center, it's a little bit unique because everyone on my team is trained in both a pediatric and obstetric anesthesia. And so the reason that's a little bit different than other places is a lot of places might have one pediatric anesthesiologist and one obstetric anesthesiologist in the room. Since we at our at Texas Children's are all trained in both, we don't have one person who's taking care of mom and one person who's taking care of, one person who's taking care of the pregnant patient and one person who's taking care of the fetus. We just work together and do all of it. And if we have something, for example, there's a resuscitation, if the fetus is not doing well and we need to get, what would be considered like CPR, for the fetus, then we kind of split off and one takes care of the mom and one takes care of the fetus so that we're focused. But during a case where everything is going smoothly, we just work pretty well together. And there's only three of us, so we're very, we have kind of a choreography about how it all works together. It's really nice to work on a team who's worked so closely together, but there will be two of us to take care of the two patients in those more complex cases.
Okay. Wow. So, if you were advising a medical student who's going into anesthesia now, who's considering anesthesia, can you tell me some of the pluses and minuses of a career in anesthesia?
Yeah, there are a lot of pluses. There are, of course, in any career, some minuses. I think one of the things that I really love about anesthesia that I don't think that I anticipated how rewarding it would be is the ability to kind of take someone through what can be the most stressful experience that they are having, whether it's a parent taking their child for surgery and that child going through surgery, or someone going through, a challenging time where they need to have heart surgery. All of these things are really stressful, and it can be a life defining moment for the patient. And you're there, and your job is to make sure that they're safe and that they're comfortable. And that's such a privilege, and it's so fulfilling to be able to take something that's really stressful and really scary and just make it, we make it better, but we make it a little bit less bad, to be able to help someone through that and relieve some of that stress and anxiety. And that is really, I think probably why I loved OB and PD the most, out of all of the subspecialties in anesthesia. That's been really rewarding. I also am kind of an instant gratification kind of person. So I like that if there's a blood pressure problem, I give something and I fix it. Or if there is pain in labor, I do an epidural and it's fixed. So it's, I like the very quick, rapid improvement in what you see. It's very gratifying to have that rather than I see that my patient has a blood pressure problem and I give them a medication and tell them to take it for 3 months and then they come back. That is so important. It's really valuable, but I like that instant feedback.
Okay, that makes sense. And I do have a saying like, where I love my work, but I don't always love my job. And yeah. And what that means is I love the work of connecting with patients one-on-one, but in outpatient medicine, I don't love the job where we're doing prior authorizations and we're having to deal with insurance companies. So what is it in anesthesia that, I think you love the work, but what is it about the job that could maybe be a little bit better that you don't always love?
I guarantee you, I will answer that, but you've made me think of something else that's really great about anesthesia that I want to point out, which is that we don't have any of that. I don't have to do any prior auths. I don't have to, when I do my charting, I do it right then. There's no charts waiting for me when I get home. So a lot of the dissatisfiers in medicine that I think really are very heavy and carry a lot of people, you know, their nights, their weekends. When I get home, my charting is done and there's none of those calls. Wow. So that's not a downside. That's a great thing about anesthesia. One of the downsides I think, and this is very particular to my area of anesthesia doing fetal, where there's relatively low volume of cases overall, but we have to be available 24/7 and there's only three of us on the team. That high availability, though low volume, is a little bit challenging, I think, for life, if you will, because I think any given night, for example, this past week I was on call from Monday at 7 till the following Monday at 7. And so I had a few smaller cases. I had a big case. I'm, you know, on call for the patient throughout that period of time while she's recovering. And that is all absolutely fine. It does make it hard on those weeks to plan things. And so I might say to my four-year-old, you know, I'll see you in the morning. And then I get called in before he wakes up. And so that kind of high availability, even though it's low volume, does make, I think, the balance between, at least having boundaries between your work and your outside of work life to be a little bit challenging.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, and let me ask you on the, it sounds like you're on 1 week out of every three. On the other 2 weeks, are you having to be on call for that?
So on those other 2 weeks, I'm not on call technically. We each on our team have a very varying roles. So one of my partners is the chief of ethics for the hospital. And so 40% of his time is ethics. So while he's not on call for a fetal, he's often focused on ethics. I have a little bit of administrative time. So I'm 20% administrative because I lead our division. Technically I'm part-time. So I have one day off per week on average. That will take up some of that time. And then the rest of the time I'm either in the pediatric OR at Texas Children's, or if we have one of those complex cases, I'll get pulled over to the fetal OR. So I won't necessarily be on call for overnight and during the weekend that week, but I might be helping my partner and we take care of the patient together. That's happening more and more because our service is getting so busy that I often will get pulled from the PDOR to go over and do one of those more complex cases on the fetal side, which during those weeks, it's quite predictable. For the most part, but every once in a while we'll have something where I, you know, anticipated a day off or a non-clinical day, and there's a complex case that comes up or needs to be rescheduled. And so I move things around, but generally people are really understanding about having to move things around for that sort of reason.
Ah, well, that makes sense. So that's interesting because I hadn't, and all of that is just so fascinating to me. And I hadn't actually thought about the whole, like, you don't have to deal with charting when you get home because you're doing it all there. Well, that's a huge benefit.
It's enormous. I had no idea because you're not charting when you get home when you're a med student. You're not thinking about how much of an impact and how much a kind of a depleting drain that can be on. It's, you know, it's not very fulfilling to do that charting. So that is a huge, huge benefit. My husband and I talk a lot about aspects of careers that we didn't think about when we were choosing a career and things that can be a good surprise and things that can be a bad surprise. For my personality, I think if I didn't have boundaries like that, I would have a really hard time turning it off. And I have other ways that I, you know, have relatively flexible boundaries. But to start a case, take care of the patient, finish the case. And even if they're still there for 4 days before they go home, you know, that's their, those 4 days, and then they go home, and I'll follow along with the team to understand what's going on with the patient. But there's a certain cadence to a start and an end. And that's really helpful for a person like me who has a hard time turning it off. When I was on ICU, for example, doing my ICU rotations as an anesthesia resident, I would be at home and checking on my patients on my phone and seeing what their vitals were and seeing how they were doing and what pressors they were on and how things were going overnight. And I had a really hard time turning it off. And so the fact that my job kind of has a beginning and an end from the clinical side, from the non-clinical side, it does not have a beginning and an end, but from the clinical side, it's kind of self-contained. I didn't think about that and think about how important that would be for my personality type. But I think it's been a really helpful thing to me. I learned about myself in residency because I couldn't very effectively turn it off.
Okay. Isn't that interesting too, about how so many things you learn just from having to do it? Like, is that anything you could have predicted before you started your residency?
Absolutely not. I mean, in, you know, med school, first of all, I never even considered doing anesthesia. So I certainly wouldn't have thought about, you know, what are the pluses and minuses on a day-to-day life. But I also, how could you possibly predict what your life will be like? I have kids now, I have a husband. I had none of that in med school. So I think there's some good things and some bad things that come as surprises in your job, but that's been a really good surprise for me.
Well, that's good. Okay. Well, that leads me to two more questions. And the first is, you did not consider anesthesia initially. So what brought you to anesthesia then?
Well, you know, I was one of those med students who really liked almost everything. I didn't really like radiology. I don't have a very good visual, spatial visual memory. So I couldn't quite grasp radiology, but I loved everything else. And I thought I majored in neuroscience in undergrad. So I had my neurology neurology rotation scheduled kind of later on. And I thought, I loved neuroscience. I'm going to love neurology. And I got to neurology and I really, it was one of the first ones that I actually didn't really care for. And I think there was, you know, some personal stuff going on. My grandmother had just had a really severe stroke. And so that was really hard to see. And it's interesting how, you know, coincidences like that can really steer and change your life path for sure. Mm-hmm. But what it felt like to me was neuroscience, and this is a very kind of anesthesia or neuroscience for dummies way of thinking for this, but what it felt like to me was neuroscience was how the brain works and how the nervous system works. And neurology in that moment in my life felt like this is the tragedy of when it doesn't work. And because of that kind of personal situation going on at the time, I was like, I can't do this. And I happened to have my anesthesia rotation shortly after. And I didn't know what an anesthesiologist did, but I had no clue that there was so much neuroscience in it. And this is how we kind of manipulate the nervous system and neuroscience. And there was just a lot of a little bit more connection to neuroscience than I anticipated. And I really enjoyed that. So that was a surprise in that way. And I also kind of had the idea, I really love people, despite being an introvert and a homebody, I really love people. And I thought, well, in anesthesia, you don't have that much connection with people. They're asleep. For one, they're not asleep when you're doing OB. But also, I think you kind of have to be even better with people to be good in anesthesia, because you have to build rapport and foster trust in like 5 minutes rather than over years. And so to take someone and wheel them away from their loved ones at a very stressful time to help them feel more comfortable, to, you know, circle back with the family, to keep everyone in the loop, to communicate those complex situations in a way that is understandable for people who don't have as much health literacy, that really takes a lot of kind of people skills, or, you know, you call them soft skills, even though they're really kind of hard. But I think it takes a lot more of that than I ever would have realized. And so those two things put together, when I did my anesthesia rotation, I was shocked that I loved it, but I really did.
I'm really glad that you shared both of those points, because the people skills is something that I learned after medical school about how important that is for anesthesiologists. Especially as a patient, you start to realize, oh my gosh, really want your anesthesiologist to be warm and nurturing and make you feel very confident in their skill.
Yeah.
But you know, the part that you just told me about neuroscience, I've actually never thought of that, Dr. Sutton, until you just educated me. But of course, you have to know so much. I don't know why it never occurred to me.
It never occurred to me. And that was what I studied, you know, but I think until, especially because anesthesia, when you're a med student or when you're first exposed to it, you're often on the surgery side, right? I don't know of anyone who does the anesthesia rotation before a surgery rotation. And so you see the anesthesiologist and often they're sitting there by themselves. Yes. And they're not talking. And so you don't know what they're doing. And okay, how could you, you know, there's a lot that you're thinking and doing and planning, but you don't do it out loud. Most people don't talk to themselves while they do it. So you would have no idea what all goes into creating a really thoughtful anesthetic. And so I don't think there's any way you could know that.
Oh, you're so right. I am thinking back now to my surgery rotations, and like behind the drape is sitting this man or woman who is, you know, just sitting there. You're right.
Yeah. I always got made fun of in residency. They called me the gopher because I would be like popping my little head over the drape to be like, what are you guys doing over there? What's happening? Because I thought, you know, I need to anticipate what's happening over there so I know what I'm doing over here. But that communication, and I love that communication exists in my team now. We communicate across the drape all the time. But depending on what kind of case you're doing and, you know, once you learn in residency, you're still figuring out what they're doing on the other side of the drape. But once you learn, there may not be as much of that. But I think that communication, when it happens, is still at a level that as a med student, you couldn't necessarily appreciate all that's going on behind the drape on the other side. The anesthesia, when you're a med student, the anesthesiologist is just standing in the best spot to view the surgery, and you just want them to scoot over so you can see the surgery, I think.
That's right. So, and I'm really glad you're sharing all of this, because anesthesiology is not, in my time, it was not required. And I think even now, correct? It's not required in most medical schools?
No, it's not. I actually only signed up for it. I went to Baylor for med school and we had that where you take the step at a little bit different time than other people because of that shortened basic science curriculum. And so I had 2 weeks that I needed to fill before I was going to take my time off to study for a step. And I was like, what will I do? And a friend told me, you should do anesthesia, but don't do OB anesthesia because everyone loves OB anesthesia. So do regular anesthesia first so you'll know if you really like it, which I remember being like, that's a very funny thing to say, but okay. And he was right. He predicted my whole life in that moment.
Right from that moment on, bam.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I know that, and you and I have spoken personally about this. So I know that you have interests and excitement even beyond the day-to-day of anesthesia. And I think it's so interesting too. Some of the physicians that I have noticed are the most excited and energized about work are constantly growing, looking at the next thing. And one of the things that I had thought of you as an anesthesiologist, I had no idea that you had this whole other area of expertise and interest in ethics. Can you tell us a little bit about that part of your career path?
Sure. I'm actually so excited to talk to you about that because I think that it's another thing that people don't necessarily think about, and you don't really know how you can get into it, and you don't know what you have to have as far as credentials or experience or that sort of thing to be able to kind of access that or get that as part of your career. And that held me back for a while. Until relatively recently have said, I'm an ethicist or, you know, I do ethics. It's just, I'd be like, oh, I'm really interested in that. But now there's quite a well-defined path as to how to do it. But it really started for me in medical school in my ethics course. I loved it. When I went to med school back in a long time ago, it was not pass-fail. There was, you know, still the pass, marginal pass, honors, high pass, whatever, the multiple grades. And I remember ethics, everyone talked about, you know, you talk to the class ahead of you and they said, well, ethics is one of the hardest ones. It's the one that has the least number of honors. And I was like, oh, really? So I was a little bit nervous about the class and it was so interesting. And I remember the reason it really captured my imagination was, you know, you get these cases, they're so complex. An ethical dilemma, I usually think of as a situation where reasonable people disagree, right? There's definitely two sides to the story. And so you get this case and you often have a gut reaction. So you read the case and you're like, oh my goodness, clear gut reaction. I would go this direction. And through learning the Baylor does an ethics workup, which I think is a really nice way to kind of think through a rational framework to solve one of those problems. Doing the ethics workup, I got to the end and I worked myself to the opposite conclusion of my gut instinct. That was the conclusion I came to was completely the opposite of what I thought initially. And that kind of blew my mind. And I thought, what am I missing? What am I not seeing? What am I not thinking about when I come across these problems? And I kind of became really interested in that. So when I went to my residency at Emory, they have a really fantastic Center for Ethics at Emory, and they did something called the Cross-Residency Ethics Program, and you would apply and your program would have to support you because it was a certain amount of time away from your clinical duties for, I can't remember how many months, but we would all come together usually on Fridays, I think, and be taught by a different expert, a different aspect of ethics. And as a result of that, I joined the ethics committee at Emory as a resident. So I was kind of going on consults with the faculty, saw how an ethics committee ran. And when I came to Texas Children's, I joined ethics. I just kind of volunteered to do it. I didn't really know how it worked, just to see how it worked in Texas Children's. And each place that I've worked, it's been really different. I now teach that class that I loved. I teach a small group. So it kind of became full circle, but I don't have a degree in ethics. I don't have a master's or a doctorate in ethics, but I do have this certification, which is a new thing by the ASBH. It's the American Society for Bioethics and Humanities, and it's kind of the leader in the field. Okay. And they've defined this certification, and you have to have a certain number of hours of experience, either through ethics consults or teaching, and they define it very clearly what counts. And once you have this, I think it's 400 hours, several hundred hours of experience over a five-year period, you're eligible to sit for the ethics exam. And once you sit for this exam, then you become a certified consultant. That was a very long answer, but it was a long road to get
That's
to.
So interesting. Well, Dr. Sutton, I might, if you're open to it, I might have you come back on a different episode to talk a little bit more about, because that is a separate career path then.
Yeah. One of the things I really like about it is it's not just physicians. They're all, the people that sit on the ethics committee. It's a minority are physicians, and that's how it should be, because a minority of people in the hospital are physicians. So it's, I get to understand what it's, what things are like for, the chaplains and the nurses and the speech therapists and community members. So it's using a different part of your brain, which I really enjoy.
Yes. Wow. Well, this has been so interesting. I think if I was going to ask you a final question for our medical students, what advice would you give to a student who is listening to this and thinks, wow, anesthesia is something I should explore? Is there anything they should do to prepare themselves for success in this area? So of course you should explore via rotation, but beyond mm-hmm. that, is there any, are there any resources or any other suggestions that you might have?
You know, I think reaching out to someone who's done it and understanding and being able to ask those questions one-on-one, because there's so much that you can't see from just spending a day in the operating room, learning what different aspects of anesthesia there are. I am embarrassed to say, I didn't even know about regional anesthesia or doing nerve blocks, that sort of thing, until I was a resident. I had never seen it. I didn't know anything about that. And so you can do your anesthesia rotation. But if you do a rotation in general anesthesia, you won't see cardiac or obstetric or pediatric or regional or critical care, all of those different things that are kind of like entirely different ecosystems from one another. So there's a lot of variety. And my job is extremely different from my best friend in residency's job who does critical care. Our jobs couldn't be more different. And so I think that's a helpful thing to do. The other thing I would say, and I think this is important for anyone who's applying for residency or applying from residency for fellowship, is to not get bogged down by the unsolicited feedback that you might get. And what I mean by that is I had a lot of people say, why would you do pediatrics and obstetrics? That doesn't make any sense. Those don't go together. That's a waste of time. You won't be able to practice both. You can't be good at two things. And I wasn't asking, you know, what do you think about this? They would just give this unsolicited, really negative feedback. And I will tell you, it took up a lot of my emotional bandwidth. It really made me question myself. It really made me doubt things for a long time. It was really challenging, and I didn't know if it would work out. I mean, I don't know, but I now have, like, I can't imagine a better job for me than what I have. And it really worked out. And I've talked to a lot of people who've had not necessarily the same choice I made, but maybe an unconventional choice. Or they kind of were creating something that combined their interests, but didn't really reflect a lot of other people's choices. And I think in the end, what I came down to was that unsolicited advice. If I think about where is it coming from, I think it says a lot more about the person's feelings about their own career than what they're thinking about for your career. And so when I spent a lot of time in residency, once I sorted through that, listening to Taylor Swift's Haters Gonna Hate, just to pump myself up for that. And I don't think it's bad intentions, but I there's a lot of well-intentioned negative feedback that you might get for your choices. And I would just urge people to set that aside and go for what they want and what makes sense for them, because it can work out really, really well.
Wow, that is incredibly insightful and helpful. And because I've thought that in the back of my mind in other times, but you just put it into such, I mean, the example you gave, and that
well, I spent a lot of time thinking about it because it was hard. I got a lot of weird negative feedback for no, like, I wasn't asking for it, but people would be like, that's crazy. What a waste of your time. That's a year of your life. And I want to be clear. I had a lot of great support from mentors. I have amazing mentors, amazing supporters who I went to and talked to about it. And they were really thoughtful and thought about how it would work out for me. I can't express how impactful that was. It was more the unsolicited, like just out of nowhere, just kind of like, you know, smash into you as you're walking down the hall, say, that's crazy. What are you doing? But it really sticks with you when people place those doubts.
That's so important that you just share that, because especially when you're a medical student or a resident or even early career physician, having somebody put those doubts in your mind, you're absolutely right. It does stay with you.
Oh man, I can remember, I don't have that great of a memory, but I can remember clear moments and people who I had never met before, I've never seen since, but they said something that I was like, oh my gosh, am I wasting a whole year of my life? Does this make any sense? Is this crazy? And it takes one of those moments to, you know, knock down the really thoughtful mentorship and support and guidance that you get from people who are being more thoughtful and careful with their thinking.
Well, I'm doubly glad you shared that too, because I started this by introducing you as your chief of the maternal fetal anesthesia division at one of the best children's hospitals in the country. And so, of course, this was something that you always felt confident about and you knew what you were doing right from the beginning. So I'm just realizing that when I'm introducing you that way, that it's really important to start at the beginning and to say, wow, well, yes, she's doing this incredible. I mean, you're involved in these incredible advances in maternal fetal. I mean, my goodness, fetal surgery. And yet, like, look where you had to start and some of the barriers that you had to overcome to get to this point. That's such a lesson for me too. Like, you can't just look at somebody where they are today, right?
Gosh, I think, you know, that we talk about it. It takes a village for raising kids. It also takes a village to get any medical career, right? The people that I think within the community of fetal anesthesia who are so supportive, I can call them middle of the night, like, what would you do in this situation? Or what do you think about this next career move? Should I agree to doing this? Or should I, you know, do that? There's so much, there are obstacles in any career, but I think that community that you build is so valuable. And we all get through all of those obstacles by having that community along as we go, because when you're doubting yourself, they help you and they bring you forward.
Isn't that the truth? Well, Dr. Sutton, thank you so much for sharing your experiences and then these fantastic insights. I really appreciate that you took the time out of your schedule to come on today and speak to us. Thank you.
Oh, it's always such a pleasure to spend time with you. Thank you so much for the invitation. And it's really been a joy.